Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences. Our guest speakers are renowned poet Terrence Hayes and Creative Writing Program alumna Ani Jika. We begin with a greeting by former poet laureate Robert Pinsky.
I welcome you here on behalf of the Boston University MFA Program in Writing and the Robert Lowell Memorial Lecture Series. I'll say a little bit about the lecture series as a way of introducing the two wonderful readers, Ani Jika and Terrence Hayes. Nancy Livingston and Fred Levin, through the Shenson Foundation, endowed this reading series as, quote, in the spirit of Room 222. Room 222, on the second floor in the building across the street, is the seminar room where Hodgin and Louise Glick and Leslie Epstein and I still teach creative writing classes, where Ani Jika was a student. And in that room, Robert Lowell taught a class in which the students included Sylvia Plath, George Starbuck, and Anne Sexton. The spirit of Room 22 means they were artists together. The fact that one was a professor or a visiting professor or whatever he was called is not as important as the fact that they were pursuing their art. In this series, a recent graduate of BU's creative writing program introduces the distinguished visitor. Tonight, we have what I believe is one of the very best American poets in the generation of people in their 40s. And I'll dare to say one of the very best American poets in the generation of people in their 30s. Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot adapted Stefan Mallarmé's expression of the poet setting out to purify the language of the tribe. I've always disliked that. There's always seemed something very wrong and repellent about that to me. Certainly not very good for American poetry or the kind of poetry I like. It isn't a tribe. It's not defined by heredity. It's not quasi-familial. It's a nation, and it is, at least in theory and in aspiration, a democratic nation. And the idea of purity has always been offensive to me. Purity in language, purity in almost any way, tends to be a suspect quality for me. In the tradition of this series, Ani Jika, the recent alum, will give a very brief reading and then introduce Terrence Hayes. In Ani's work, as in the work of the senior poet Terrence, language is alive, not to purity, but to the way always something new, some new admixture, some new cultural factor is always challenging and amending what we thought the culture was. It is to intuit and respond to the language of the nation and of the globe, of the world. And in Ani's wonderful book that we're very proud of, Bread on Running Waters, you have English seen afresh from the native language spoken in Albania, from English as it was heard in Asia, and English as it's about to be and will be. I'm very proud to introduce the poet who will introduce Terrence Hayes, Ani Jika.
Thank you, Robert. That was really generous, and I feel really honored to be here tonight, and thank you, Becca, as well for inviting me. I will be reading four poems. The first one is called Inarticulate. I have no memory of it. I believe a river caught up with us when we curved the foot of the mountain. My father cupped his hands, and I gulped mouthfuls. Snow patches led the way to the cool black smoke of the woods. Over our heads, eagles played tag with the white sun. The way we changed the valley, entering it like winter shadows. I never dream of it, but I remember being watched as I stood at the edge of water, stirring images with my foot. Children's story. 1. Chimi ate ants every day. He picked them up with two fingers, looked at them first, then staring into space, thoughtlessly put them into his mouth. He always chose the black, slow-moving ones, maybe because they were quiet and slow like him. Last week, his runaway mother returned and took Chimi out to dinner. They were sitting silently at the table, and when she finally said, "I've missed you," a black sea of ants crawled out of Chimi's mouth and drowned the space between them. 2. On rainy days, we'd go to Gilda's place. Me, Elona, Yonida, Fiori. Gilda had a balcony. We'd go out there and talk to the boys. Gilda lived on the first floor, so we could touch hands with the boys. Except the balcony had iron bars because you must protect yourselves from thieves. So we could touch hands with the boys, with bars touching ours. 3. He must have been 9 years old when he dipped a cat in gasoline, set it on fire, and watched it run around in circles. The mad cat dance, he called it. "Come watch the mad cat dance," he told us. But we ran away, leaving him there alone to watch the cat spin and hear it cry from its stomach. He buried it afterwards, sobbing all through the digging. 4. We played forgotten games, chalked genitals on the street. Nobody learned a thing in school. Nobody ever moved away till Miss Luli moved in to teach history in red heels, ponytail, and glasses, hands like orchids. And we raced to buy notebooks at Pandey's down Avenue of the Owls. We loved her little mouth when she spoke of cathedrals and one Jack the Ripper. And when it rained, we used to watch her pay attention to each drop till she'd forget to talk. Everyone stopped going out to play. Everyone started to get A's, except for Chimi, who skipped class one morning, shirt tucked under his perfect whale of a belly, bucket in hand, knife packed in his shoes. He went straight into Miss Luli's garden and slit her roses' throats, then threw sardines all over them and left a note. "So that you remember, miss. So that we're history. Together. Love, Chimi." This next one is called White Noise. We sat around our small table, the balcony French doors wide open to the breeze, the flies. I could hear the neighbors above and my friend Miri chasing a tire down the street. Each family eavesdropped on the next like clockwork. My mother ladled soup in four bowls. I remember her white ankles, taking her in and out of the kitchen, and my father never moving to help her. He liked to watch her like I did. We sat together like this only on Sundays. Grandmother translated for us from Greek. "Throw your bread on running waters, and you'll see that it comes back to you." She'd hide the book under her pillow, then finally sit down to eat. Nobody I loved was taken into the woods and shot. In the summer, I met my half-brother for the first time. His head shaved like a soldier's. He came back to us when I didn't know how to know him. At supper, my father didn't know how to help either. He made jokes about girls, then asked about his grades. When my parents visit us, I prepare a meal, pass the bread, wait for a toast, and sit quietly like my father, listening to everyone's insignificant confessions. We hardly ever talk of his son, who lives permanently away. Somehow, all absence of speech replaces his absence, or everyone's regrets, or everything that's been thrown away. At the landing, they turn to wave goodbye, looking up at us. My father's silver head looks smaller every time I see him. The parentheses around my mother's mouth more prominent now from withholding. My husband shuts the door. It's windy out. I part the curtains and watch them get in the car. Watch whatever is rushing against them. And the last poem is called Voice. One. The one-bedroom apartment slept three people in the living room and my parents in the bedroom. They let me glue posters of my latest crush on their bedroom walls, Axl Rose, James Dean, Johnny Depp, Cindy Crawford. I used to fall asleep on their bed, looking at long faces I'd make out on the rings of the old oak closet. Long horse faces, long cow faces, a man in a top hat when sunlight fell on the cow. When my brother and I shared the living room, sometimes our grandmother startled us in the dark, getting up to say more prayers. She lived in the kitchen side of the living room with her dead daughter's never-used catheter bags, kept in a small wooden suitcase under her bed. My grandmother and her Bible and her Jesus painting, her black stockings, her colorful aprons, and her bridal lace gloves tucked between sheets in an old dresser. My parents built a kitchen in the balcony, and in the bedroom, and in the bathroom, my mother boiled our clothes over a small kerosene stove. As a child, I remember dreaming one night, my whole family on a black sailboat in the middle of our living room, trying to hang on to the rails, trying not to think of sinking in the rolling black ocean below. Two. Why come back here? The house is no longer mine. Grandparents are long gone. I don't recognize the neighbors. Apparently, I have an accent here, too. The city's face has changed. I cannot tell when it began. Buildings and cars strewn about as if a naughty child had taken all his toys and thrown them in a fit on the floor. Three. On the cross-section figure of a tree trunk, you can make out her first year of growth. If the space between tree rings is wide, it indicates a rainy season. If it's narrow, the season was dry. You can even tell when she was scarred from forest fire and how she kept growing. And there's an old wound that began to change her face. Four. Once a young woman ran to curse the ocean. She was aware of her own weight against the sand and her fists tearing the air. She cried, "Damn you and your rolling waves," always having something to say. But the water put his hand over her mouth, and the waves said, "The time will come when you too will speak, unrestrainedly, like a church bell. You will say everything you want to say. It will mean exactly what you want it to mean. And everyone will listen. Everyone knows you are here. And when the time comes for you to be quiet again, you will be quiet, like the jasmine garden in the evening. And that is all right. You have a mouth." Thank you. Terrence Hayes was born in Columbia, South Carolina, in 1971. He received a BA from Coker College in Hartsville, South Carolina, and an MFA from the University of Pittsburgh writing program. He is the author of Lighthead, which won the National Book Award for Poetry, Wind in a Box, Hip Logic, which won the 2001 National Poetry Series, and was a finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Award, and Muscular Music, winner of the Kate Tufts Discovery Award. He has been a recipient of many honors and awards, including a Whiting Writers Award, a Pushcart Prize, 3 Best American Poetry Selections, and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts Fellowship and the Guggenheim Foundation. Of his latest collection, Lighthead, Youssef Komunyakaa says, "Terence Hayes is a master of insinuation. In this new collection of edgy poems, the work has the feel of the neo-bluesman whispering existential rifts against modern chaos. His language negotiates the flux and accepts the ragged edges of things, and is always determined to be anything but lighthearted or lightweight. The earned humor in these pages is bittersweet. Love and pathos live under the skin of innuendo. Lighthead is genius at work." So I hope that you can understand how I was feeling while I was trying to walk from my dining room to the kitchen the other day, thinking about how am I going to introduce Terence Hayes tonight. And as I was thinking about that, I bumped my head on this glass beaded garland that is on the doorway to my kitchen. And those beads, well, the garland broke and the glass beads scattered all over and shattered and all over, basically all over the dining room floor. There were shards of glass everywhere. And I knew this was the metaphor I wasn't looking for, but which just kind of snuck up on me. And if you've read any interviews with Terence Hayes, you know that that's his favorite kind of game with poetry, which he calls an animal that we work to tame and train. So I had to go with this metaphor. Writing or giving an introduction to someone whose work you truly admire is such a revealing kind of task. I think it says as much about the person being introduced as it does about the person giving the introduction. In introducing Terence Hayes today, I am deeply aware of how difficult this task is and of how limited by language I feel. It's so important to be honest, but sometimes praise and honesty are strangers to each other. Many people will tell you that Terence Hayes' poetry resists definition, but like those beads that scattered and broke everywhere in my kitchen floor the other day, his poetry will disarm you. You'll have to stop everything you're doing and listen, not because of his ridiculously good looks, although he's ridiculously good looking, or his inventiveness with language and style, although that is obviously what distinguishes him from other poets. But you will listen because of how acutely present the speaker in his poems is, and how deeply this speaker loves being here. In his poem, "A House Is Not Home," Hayes writes, "When you have no music, everything becomes a form of music. I bet somewhere in Mississippi there is a skull that only a sharecropper's daughter can make sing. I'll steal that sound. More than anything, I want to work at the African American Acoustic and Audiological Accident Insurance Institute so that I can record the rumors and raucous rhythms of my people, our jangled history, the slander in our sugar, the ardor in our anger, a subcategory of which probably includes the sound particular to one returning to his feet after a friend has knocked him down." So it seems to me there is something lacking in poetry today, and perhaps in America in general, a sense of trust in language, in the language that we use to address and communicate with one another. And when there is no trust, you already desperately imagine it everywhere. But here in Terence Hayes' verse, you will find a speaker who has the courage to show what falls apart and the joy to celebrate renewal. There is imagination here, but more importantly, there is candor here. And when you read him, you'll have the unmistakable sense that, like a music that you hear playing in the dark, which helps ground you, this speaker is not that far away either, and you can trust his poetry to reassemble our shattered realities. It is with deepest honor that I introduce you, Terence Hayes.
Oh. Okay, let me get my time right here. Thanks, Ani. I told you I don't like introductions, but that was good. That was, I was like, okay, as soon as you did the beads thing, I was with you. So I appreciate that, and it was great. This is always better. To read with another poet is always better than reading alone, like with most things. So good work. We'll talk about it later, all the images, you know, sofas on black seas and all of that. So, yeah, I guess, I go back and forth. I have a bunch of new stuff, and I actually have not read from this book in about a year, you know, as I've been running around. So I sort of thought maybe I should read from it. And then I have a poem that I feel like is, you know, very definitely in the spirit of Lowell that I've really been wanting to read. I think it's done, but I'm sort of afraid to read it first, just in case it's like, you know, it's not good, you know. So I guess I will start with the book. So it's good to be here. This is a weird room. It's like science fiction with the, it's almost like you guys are watching a screen, you know, you're like in the, what do you call it, the spill-off room or something. Great to be here with Robert. Charming, intelligent, great storyteller. I always heard you were a good storyteller. I know stories that you told that you didn't tell me. It's just that people repeat them. So, and I had that feeling tonight, like, I'm going to be telling that story. And I'll mention you when I tell it, but I'm going to mostly tell it like you tell it. Like, oh, let me tell you this story. Anyway, so really, you know, great. You feel like an old friend, and you are. That's the good thing about good poets. You know them before you know them. So anyway, all right, so I won't read long, like 2 hours. So here's the first poem, Lighthead's Guide to the Galaxy. It's sort of an Ars Poetica. I was talking today in the Q&A about a teacher, a brilliant alcoholic horse rancher, English professor, and Faulknerian scholar. So a real hard ass is what I would say. I'm not going to talk like this about all the poems. I'm just trying to like shake my nerves, you know. But he just has a moment in the poem. And the poem is really almost like a bunch of little Ars Poeticas. But what I would say is for as hard and, I mean, he looked like Cary Grant, so he was cool too. But he definitely had some issues. But at one point, he was reading Joyce to us after he had, you know, maybe just told two girls to get out, like, you dumb fat cows, get out of my room. This is how the kind of person he was. So, you know, that's not nice. But he was reading Molly Bloom's soliloquy that comes, you know, late in Ulysses, and then he just broke down. He just started crying. So either he was mentally disturbed or had a capacity to be tremendously moved by language. And so it's a cameo, but I always like to take the opportunity just to give him a shout out. You know, he's passed on now. Anyway, all right, so here we go. I'm going to read now. Lighthead's Guide to the Galaxy. Ladies and gentlemen, ghosts and children of the state, I am here because I could never get the hang of time. This hour, for example, would be like all the others were it not for the rain falling through the roof. I'd better not be too explicit. My night is careless with itself, troublesome as a woman wearing no bra in winter. I believe everything is a metaphor for sex. Lovemaking mimics the act of departure. Moonlight drips from the leaves. You can spend your whole life doing no more than preparing for life and thinking, is this all there is? Thus, I am here where poets come to drink a dark, strong poison with tiny shards of ice, something to loosen my primate tongue and its syllables of debris. I know all words come from pre-existing words and divide until our pronouncements develop selves. The small dog barking at the darkness has something to say about the way we live. I'd rather have what my daddy calls scrimp. He says discreet and means the street just out of sight. Not what you see, but what you perceive, that's poetry. Not the noise, but its rhythm, an arrangement of derangements. I'll eat you to live. That's poetry. I wish I glowed like a brown-skinned pregnant woman. I wish I could weep the way my teacher did as he read us Molly Bloom's soliloquy of yes. When I kiss my wife, sometimes I taste her caution. But let's not talk about that. Maybe art's only purpose is to preserve the self. Sometimes I play a game in which my primitive craft fires upon an alien ship whose intention is the destruction of the earth. Other times I fall in love with a word like somberness or moonlight juicing naked branches. All species have a notion of emptiness, and yet the flowers don't quit opening. I am carrying the whimper you can hear when the mouth is collapsed, the wisdom of monkeys. Ask a glass of water why it pities the rain. Ask the lunatic yard dog why it tolerates the leash. Brothers and sisters, when you spend your nights out on a limb, there's a chance you'll fall in your sleep. All right, so that's the first poem of the book. I think I'm ready to do this Carpenter poem now. See, I said I wasn't going to talk, but you know, the thing about new poems is that you do have to talk to the room because you don't really know what you're doing necessarily. So I'm gonna talk through this one, and then I won't do any more talking. A little bit more. So quick, you know, someone, a poet who has a carpentry background, maybe you know this about Yusuf, you know, emailed me in December and was like, "Do you have any carpentry poems?" And I was like, "No, like, who does? Especially me." So, but I was like, "Oh, I like a challenge. I'll see what happens." So I tried. It didn't work out. And then I was also working on this thing about Lowell. And it really started with "I myself am hell," which is like my favorite Lowell line from Skunk Hour. "And my mind's not right." Now that's my favorite line. But why is that now my favorite line? Because "I myself am hell" is Milton, which I did not know. I thought it was Lowell. And so there's this whole thing that started about influence and where things come from. Anyway, so he was just talking about how he wrote Skunk Hour. He imitated the structure and mood of the armadillo, which he said, "Oh, it just sort of drifts, and then it winds up talking about some sort of animal." So then I thought, okay, carpenter poem, animals, and my wife's aunt, I say, though some people say aunt, and that's important, who taught herself to carpenter. So it's called The Carpenter Aunt, but A-N-T. All right, I think that's all you know. That's it. I mean, maybe you don't even need to know that. But it's, you know, it's Lowell structures. So I feel like I owe him. So that's why I was excited to read it here, because he got me going. The Carpenter Aunt. It was when or because she became two kinds of mad, both a feral nail biting into a plank and a deranged screw cranking into a wood beam, the aunt, I shouldn't say her name, went at the fullest hour of the night, the moon there like an unflowered bulb in a darkness like mud or covered in mud as a bulb or a skull is covered in mud. The small brown aunt who, before she went mad, taught herself to carpenter and unhinged in her madness the walls she claimed were bugged with the tiny red-eyed device planted by the state or Satan's agents, ghost of atheist, her foes, or worse, the walls were full of the bugs she believed crawled from her former son-in-law's crooked mouth. The aunt, who knows, as all creatures know, you have to be rooted in something tangible as wood if you wish to dream in peace, took her hammer with its claw like a mandible to her own handmade housing, humming, "I don't know why God keeps blessing me," softly, madly, and I understood. I was with her when the pallbearers carried a box made of mahogany from her church to a hearse to a hole in the earth. It made me think of the carpenter aunt who carries within its blood an evolved self-destructive property, and on its face mandibles twice the size of its body, and can carry on its back, as I have seen on TV, a rotted bird or branch great distances to wherever the queen is buried. Kingdom Alimalia, phylum Arthropoda, tribe Camponotini, the species that lives on wood is, like mud, rain, and time, the carpenter's enemy. Yes, but I would love to devour the house I live in until it is a permanent part of me. I would love to shape as Perumthachan, the master sculptor, carpenter, and architect of India is said to have shaped, a beautiful tree into the coffin in which I am buried. I know whatever we place in a coffin, the coffin remains empty. I know nothing buried is buried. I don't know why God keeps blessing me. I don't know why God keeps blessing me. So it's supposed to be one sentence, so I guess, you know, you get a little breathless with those long sentences. There's some armadillo skunk hour influence. All right, so yeah, we'll see how things go. I don't know if I'll get back to the book. So this is Black Confederate Ghost Story. It's all in the poem. All right. Attention, African American apparitions, hung, burned, or drowned before anyone alive was born. Please make a mortifying midnight appearance before the handyman standing on my porch this morning with a beard as wild as Walt Whitman's. Except he is the anti-Whitman, this white man with Confederate pins littering his denim cap and jacket. And by mortify apparitions, I mean scare the shit out of him. I wish I were as tolerant as Walt Whitman waltzing across the battlefield like a song covering a cry of distress. But I want to be a storm covering a Confederate parade. The handyman's insistence that there were brigades of Black Confederates is as oxymoronic as terms like civil war. Free slave. It is the opposite of history. Goodbye plantations doused in Sherman's fire and homely, lonesome women weeping over blue and gray bodies. Goodbye colored ghosts. You could have headed north if there was a south to flee. In Louisiana, north still begins with Mississippi, as far as I know. East is Alabama, west is Texas, and here is this fool telling me there were blacks who fought to preserve slavery. Goodbye, slavery. Hello, black accomplices and accomplished blacks. Hello, Robert E. Lee bobblehead doll on the handyman's dashboard, whistling Dixie across our post-racial country. Last night, I watched several hours of television and saw no blacks. NASDAQ, NASCAR, nada black. I wish there were more ghost stories about lynched Negroes haunting the mobs that lynched them. Do I believe no one among us was alive between 1861 and 1865? I do, and I don't. We all have somewhere to go, and we are probably already there. I know only one ghost story featuring a brother in Carrollton, Alabama, dragged to the center of town in a storm for some crime he didn't commit. As he was hung, lightning struck a window on the courthouse he's been haunting ever since. Attention, apparitions. This is a solicitation very much like a prayer. Your presence is requested tonight when this man is polishing his Civil War relics and singing good old rebel soldier to himself. Hello, sliding chairs. Hello, vicious whispering shadows. I'm a reasonable man, but I want to be as inexplicable as something hanging a dozen feet in the air. So I got some crazy stuff. I know y'all probably think that's crazy. I leave the crazy stuff at home, mostly. And then I just put it in the books. So, but here's one, I guess, that's a little bit loony. It's called Wig Frastic. You know, it's crazy when you can't get up a good title for it. So it's like, it's about wigs, is what I would say to you. I thought of another line the other day to maybe put in it. But this is what it is for now. So wig frastic. So just don't ask me any questions about it, is what I would say to you. Just go with it. And then later on, we'll be back into like a recognizable realm. Oh, okay. So what can I tell you about it? Norman Mailer, hipster. Well, I can say this because, you know, I read this poem. I never get the laughs on the wigger part. And then whack, which is a version of that. I should say this. So there's a line in here. I was just listening to the radio, and it was around the Trayvon Martin moment, and there was a guy in, like, Western Pennsylvania, which is different from Pittsburgh, Western Pennsylvania public radio, and he said, you know, whenever there's a crisis, any kind of crisis, talking about the phenomena of everybody sort of being up in arms about the Trayvon Martin story, whenever there's a crisis, he said, calamity pimps come out of the woodwork and start to paddle their own canoes. So I was like, wow, what a awesome sentence. And how, you know, like, foul it was that he said it. Like, to have such a, like, completely warped sensibility in such an awesome sentence. So I had to figure out a way to put that in here. It probably don't even belong in here, but that's in here. All right. Wig frastic. Sometimes I want a built-in scalp that looks and feels like skin, a form of camouflage protection against sunburn and frostbite, horse hair that covers the nightmares and makes me civilized. Somebody slap a powdered wig on me so I can hammer a couple sentences like Louis XIV, small and bald as a boiled egg, making himself taller by means of a towering hairpiece resembling a Corinthian column, or maybe a skyscraping kid with no play wig worn by someone playing niggas with attitudes at a penthouse party with no black people. We up in the club humming, hey mama, and our numb skull caps underscore the brain's captivity. Somebody slap me. Norman Mailer's essay, The White Negro, Superficial Reflections on the Hipster, never actually uses the word wigger. I'd rather say whack. It may be fruitful to consider me a philosophical psychopath. We clubbing in our wigs of pleas and pathological coulda, woulda, shouldas, oblong with longing. The ladies wear wigs of no-nos and knots, knots of knots, do-nots, cannots, ought-nots, wigs dipped in dye the color of cosmopolitans, citrus, wheat beer swirling on their scalps, off their scalps, side of scalps, their center parts and irrigated plaits. Flirty bangs dangle below a bow clip of sparkle. A lady places her bow about face to place her face in place, which is a placebo of place. Her face is a placebo. Let's wear ready-made wigs, custom-made wigs, hand-tied wigs, and machine-made wigs. No Negro can saunter down a street with any real certainty that violence will not visit him, wrote Mailer in his essay. Bullets shout through the darkness. Dumb people are dangerous. Calamity pimps come out of the woodwork and start to paddle their own canoes. This was the white dude's response to the death of Martin. Later, let's beat that apathy wig right off him. You wear the shark head wig, and I'll wear the wig of tide water rising to the ceiling. You wear the buckaroo wig, and I'll wear the wig of tumbleweed. And when anyone says, you look beautiful, reply, I feel beautiful, like the beautiful shoulder-length locks shorn from a cancer-stuffed bride in need of money. Let's get higher than God tonight, like the military wives of Imperial Rome, smiling in the blonde and red-headed wigs cut from the scalps of enemy captives. Somebody slap me. We awash in liquor, watching the coils curl, curls coil, coils coil, curls curl on the girls. Non-slip polyurethane patches.
superfine lace, Isis wigs, Cleopatra wigs, big booty Judy wigs, under the soft radar-streaked music of Climax singing, the men all paws, animals, the men all fangles, the men all wolf woofs, a little bit lost, lust, lustrous, trustless, restless as the rest of us. In my life, the wigs eat me. The wish to live a while on the mind of another human is not inhuman. The wish to slide for a while inside another human, it is not inhuman. If you like I like, you should wear a hairpiece. It is peace of mind. It is artistic. It is a lightweight likeness, comfortable, wash and wear, virtually looking and feeling with virtually no side effects. Let me hear you say, this wig is terrific. A colored despair wig for your colored despair. An economic despair wig, a sexual despair wig, a wig for expressive despair, political despair, a movable halo. New and improved, your wig can be set upon the older wig, just as the older wig was set when it was newer upon the wig beneath it. Where's your wig? Wear your wig. Your wig is terrific. So, I told you not to ask me any questions. So don't. Let me see. Am I in the right order here? I think I'm. Missed some stuff. It looks like I have two more, but I thought I had another one in here somewhere. Is that it? Where is that other poem? Yeah, let's see. The deer poem. I guess I should say muscadine. If you don't know Climax, you probably don't know the muscadine either. It's a kind of berry from the South. They have muscadine wine. It's a nasty little thing, but it's actually not bad. It looks nasty, but it tastes, it's an acquired taste. So there's that. I think that's all you got to know, just the muscadine. Pataskala, it's a place, a town in Ohio. I mean, what poet has ever gone through Pataskala and not wound up saying Pataskala in a poem? So there's that. The deer. I'm reading long sentences tonight, is what I'm realizing. So this too began as one long sentence, but eventually I broke it up. So just go with it. Outside Pataskala, I saw the deer with a soft white belly, the deer with two eyes as blind as holes. I saw it leap from a bush beside the highway as if a moment before it leapt, it had been a bush beside the highway. And I saw how, if I wished it, I could be the deer, a creature bony as a branch in spring. And when I closed my eyes, I found the scent of muscadine, the berry my mother plucked Sundays from the roadside where fumes toughened its speckled skin and seeds slept suspended in a mucus thick as the sleep of an embryo. It is the ugliest berry along the road, but chewed, it reminded me of speed. And I saw, when I was the deer, that I didn't have to be a deer. I could become a machine with a woman inside it, moving at a speed that leaves a stain on the breeze and on the muscadine's flesh, which is almost meat, the sweet pulp a muscadine leaves when it's crushed in the teeth of a deer, or a mother for that matter, or her child waiting with something like shame to be fed a berry uglier than shame. Though it is not like this for the deer, it is not shame because the deer is not human. It is only almost human when it looks on the road and leaps, covering at least 30 feet in a blink. The deer I cannot be, the dumb deer, dumb and foolish enough to ignore anything that runs but is not alive, a trafficking machine filled with a distracted mind and body, deadly and durable enough to deconstruct a deer when it leaps, I'm telling you, like someone being chased. I remember a friend told me how, when he was 8 or 9, a half-naked woman ran to the car window, crying her man was after her with a knife. but his mother locked the doors and sped away. Someone tell him his mother was not a coward. That's what he thinks. Tell him it was because he and his little brother were in the car. She would not let the troubled world inside. It was no one's fault. The mind separated from the body. I could almost see the holes of her eyes, the white fuzz on her tongue, the raised buds soft as a bed of pink seeds, the hole of a mouth stretched so wide it could hold a whole baby inside. I could almost see its eyes at the back of her throat. I could definitely hear its cries. Okay, yeah. This is the last one. It's all in the poem, I guess. I did mention, actually it was just in the ride. I didn't say it in the Q&A, that, you know, I grew up in a family of men, including my mother, who they used to call her Joe Frazier when she was in high school, really. Not because she looked like Joe Frazier, but because she was whooping ass like Joe Frazier. And so she was a prison guard, and one of her most famous people that came through, and it was like, you know, minimum or whatever, I don't know, medium security, was James Brown. That's in the poem. I just like to say it, you know. You know, sometimes you think, well, if I got to write the poem so that I can tell that story, you know. So there it is. How to be drawn to trouble. The people I live with are troubled by the way I have been playing Please, Please, Please by James Brown and the Famous Flames all evening, but they won't say. I've got a lot of my mother's music in me. James Brown is no longer a headwind of hot grease and squealing for ladies with leopard-skinned intentions, stoned on horns and money. Once, I only knew his feel-good music. While my mother watched Convict's Dream, I was in my bedroom pretending to be his echo. I still love the way he says, please, 10 times straight, bending one syllable until it sounds like three. Trouble is one of the ways we discover the complexities of the soul. Once my mother bit the wrist of a traffic cop, but was not locked away because, like him, she was an officer of the state. She was a guard at the prison in which James Brown was briefly imprisoned. There had been broken man-made laws, physical and spiritual imbroglios, a car chase melee, a roadblock of troopers in sunblock and sunglasses with possibly no eyes behind them. I, for one, don't trust the police because they go around looking to eradicate trouble. T-R-O-U, you better believe in trouble. Trouble is how we learn what the soul is. James Brown, that brother, could spice up any sentence he was uttered or given. His accent made it sound like he was pleading whether he was speaking or singing. A woman can make a man sing. After another of my mother's disappearances, my father left her bags on the porch. My father believes a man should never dance in public. Under no circumstances should a grown man have hair long enough to braid. If I was a black girl, I'd be mad. I might weep too and break. But think about the good things. My mother and I love James Brown in a cape and sweat like glitter that glows like little bits of gold. In the Polaroid she took with him, he holds her wrist oddly, probably unintentionally covering her scar. There's the trouble of being misunderstood and the trouble of being soul brother number one, soul brother Godfather Dynamite. Add to that the trouble of shouting, I got to get out, I got to get down, I got to get on up the road. For many years, there was a dancing competition between my mother and father, though rarely did they actually dance. They did not scuffle like drums or cymbals, but something sluggish and close to earth. You know how things work when they don't work? I want to think about the good things. The day after the Godfather of Soul finished signing just that all over everything in the prison, all my mother wanted to talk about were his shoes. For some reason, he had 6 or 7 pairs of Italian leather beneath his bunk, suggesting the places he'd been, even if for the moment he wasn't going anywhere. Think about how little your feet would touch the ground if you were on your knees pleading 2 or 3 times a day. There are theories about freedom, and there is a song that says, "None of us are free." My mother had gone out Saturday night and came home Sunday an hour or so before church. She punched clean through the porch window when we wouldn't let her in. I can still hear all the love buried under all the noise she made. But sometimes I hear it wrong. It's not James Brown making trouble. It's James Brown being drawn to trouble. "Baby, you done me wrong, took my love, and now you're gone." It's trouble he's asking to stay. My father might have said please when my mother was beating the door and then calling to me from the window. I might have heard her say please just before or just after the glass and then the skin along her wrist broke. Please, 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 please. That's how James Brown says it. Please, 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 please. Honey, please don't go. Thank y'all.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a poetry reading presented by the Boston University Creative Writing Program in the College of Arts and Sciences and featuring Terrence Hayes and Ani Jika. We began with an introduction by former poet laureate Robert Pinsky. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.